We begin the Catechism of the Council of Trent for Parish Priests, issued by order of Pope Pius V, translated into English with notes by John A. McHugh, O.P., and Charles J. Callan, O.P. Neil Obstott, A.J. Scanlon, Imprimatur, Patricius J. Hayes, 3 January, 1923. Introduction. It has been commonly asserted by non-Catholic writers that prior to the religious rebellion of the 16th century, catechisms and catechetical instruction, in fact all religious education of the people, had long been neglected, and that to Luther and the Reformers was due the revival of the practice of the ancient church. From the days of the apostles and during the first centuries, very careful attention was given to Christian doctrine. But in the Middle Ages, we are told, the zealous practices of early times were relaxed, instruction was given up, and ignorance of the things of faith prevailed generally among the common people. That the requirements for admission into the primitive church were exacting and thorough, and that catechetics, or simply instructions in the fundamental teachings of Christianity, were diligently imparted in those early times, are facts too well known and universally admitted to require any special proof here. It is clear from the writings of the fathers, from the ancient liturgies, and from the decrees of the first councils that the catechumens, before their baptism, were obliged to learn by heart the Our Father and the Apostles' Creed, and had to be instructed in the meaning of these formulas. In addition, special instruction was also given them regarding the commandments and those sacraments they were about to receive, namely, baptism, confirmation, and the Holy Eucharist. It was to assist the labor of catechists that two famous books of instruction were composed in the 4th century, the Catechetical Oration of St. Gregory of Nyssa and St. Augustine's De Catechizandis Rudibus, and that instruction was regularly given to all the faithful on Sundays during the Eucharistic celebration, or Mass, we are assured by early authorities, such as Justin Martyr, Origen, Eutheria, the Apostolic Constitutions, and St. Germain. At Jerusalem, indeed, in the first centuries, we know that not one, but many sermons were preached after the reading of the Gospel at Mass. Not a few homilies of this early period have come down to us. Of these, one of the oldest is the work known as the Second Epistle of Clement, written about 130 A.D., which was in reality an exhortation to lead a Christian life, and was used in the meetings of the faithful. Other similar but more celebrated sermons are to be met with in the writings of all the greater fathers. Among the early popes we find such distinguished preachers as Leo the Great and Gregory the Great. In Milan, St. Ambrose's eloquence was renowned. At Hippo, St. Augustine delivered short, colloquial instructions to his flock every Sunday and feast day. At Arles, St. Caesarius was a zealous advocate of preaching and enjoined upon all his priests, both in the cities and in the country, to preach the word to the people. At Antioch and Constantinople, St. John Chrysostom became the most famous preacher of all time, surpassing his illustrious contemporaries Gregory of Nazianzen and Basil, who were celebrated as sacred orators throughout all the East. It would take too long to enumerate here all the great teachers of Christian doctrine that flourished during the early centuries, and it's really not necessary, since, as said above, it's readily admitted that religious instruction of the people was not commonly neglected throughout the patristic period. The whole question, therefore, centers about the Middle Ages, that is, from the beginning of the 7th to the 16th century. But a glance at this period will also show that there was no general neglect of proper instruction even during these centuries. This is evident, in the first place, from the many national and provincial councils held in various countries, commanding priests to instruct their people in the doctrines of faith, especially those contained in the Apostles' Creed and the Pater Noster. Already in 529, the Council of Aison had obliged the priest of Gaul to take boys into their household and teach them to read the Psalms and the Holy Scriptures, and to instruct them in the law of God. This same council refers to a custom of this kind already existing in Italy. It was from these priest schools that the parochial schools of the Middle Ages and of modern times took their origin. Mention of such parish schools appear in the acts of several councils of England, France, and Italy in the early Middle Ages. For instance, the Council of Clovesshoe in England, convened in 749, prescribed that the parish priest should always have in his house a school of learners, and that he should not demand for this instruction any recompense from the parents. Likewise, Theodulf of Orleans in 797 decreed that gratuitous instruction should be given by the priests in every town and village of his diocese. A similar enactment is to be found in the constitutions of Otto of Vercelli. The Council of Mayence in 813 decreed in its 45th canon that parents should send their sons to the parish schools to learn in the vernacular the Our Father, the Creed, and all else that was needful for instruction in the Catholic faith. A council held in Rome in 826 ordained that there should be three kinds of schools established throughout Christendom: episcopal, parochial, in towns and villages, and others wherever there could be found place and opportunity. In the same century, we learn that both boys and girls attended the schools attached to the parish churches in the diocese of Sosuan. Episcopal schools for the training of clerics and monastic centers for the education of the children of the neighborhood go back to the 4th or 5th century. In the 6th century, we hear of convent schools for girls, as at Arles, and also of open schools conducted by nuns for the benefit of the entire neighborhood. Throughout the Middle Ages, monastic schools flourished all over Europe. The children of the rich and poor alike frequented these schools, and instruction was imparted gratis. Nay, we even read that in these institutions, the poor children were sometimes nourished at the expense of the monastery. Toward the close of the medieval period, communities of clerics were founded for the express purpose of devoting their lives to the education of the young. Of these, the best known is that of the Brothers of the Common Life, founded by Gerard Groot, 1340 to 1384, and Thomas a Kempis was a member of this community. Besides the parochial and monastic schools, there were still others established during the Middle Ages for the purpose of instructing children. Such were the chantry or endowed schools, where the poor were instructed free of charge. There were also guild, hospital, and city schools, all engaged in the work of education under the direction of the church. In short, we may say with the best historians that throughout the Middle Ages, schools for religious and secular education were very numerous and well attended wherever circumstances permitted. The spirit of the church during all this period is clearly reflected in the words of the Third Lateran Council of 1179, which says, "Since the Church of God, as a pious mother, is bound to provide that opportunity for learning should not be withdrawn from the poor, who are without help from patrimonial riches, be it ordained that in every cathedral there should be a master to teach both clerics and poor scholars gratis." In the period just before the Reformation, countless elementary schools existed in all the principal countries of Europe, so much so that Martin Luther himself said that it was almost impossible for a child to go ignorant under the papacy. Even Mathesius, one of the most bitter of the reformers, admitted that parents and schoolmasters taught their children the Ten Commandments, the Creed, and the Our Father, as I in my childhood learnt them at school and often repeated them with the other children, as was the custom in the olden schools. Nor was religious instruction in medieval times neglected in the home and in the church. From the first centuries, great stress was laid on religious training in the family. In this connection, we need only recall the names of such Christian mothers as Monica and Paula to understand how faithfully this duty was fulfilled. In the writings of the fathers, also, baptismal sponsors are frequently reminded of the serious obligations that rested upon them of providing for the religious education of their godchildren, and that these early customs were zealously transmitted down to the 16th century, we are assured by conciliar decrees and similar documents which repeatedly called the duties of religious training incumbent on parents and godparents. In Luther's own day, elementary religious training in the home was by no means overlooked. Beale, in 1510, asks in a sermon that parents prepare their children for First Communion. And in 1533, Cochlaeus, speaking of customary home instruction in Germany, says that the children had sucked in their religion, as it were, with their mother's milk, and this is still the case today among Catholics, in his words. As for the instruction given in the churches, there can be no doubt that the ancient custom of preaching on the Sunday Gospels and Epistles was not given over during the Middle Ages. We may take the practice among the Anglo-Saxons as fairly typical of others. There, the parish priest was required to expound in English on Sundays the portion of Scripture proper to the Mass of the day, and to preach, or if he were unable to preach, to read at least from a book some lesson of instruction. Collections of homilies made for purposes of preaching and sermon books were quite numerous, even in the early Middle Ages, which goes to show that the ministry of the word was by no means a dead letter. And not only were the clergy obliged to instruct the people, but the latter were also seriously admonished to be present at sermons, as we learn from such popular manuals of religious instruction as the 15th century Divus et Pauper. Doctrinal discourses on the Our Father and the Creed, similar to those which the early fathers had given to the catechumens, were also customary. Lenten sermons on the catechism, which were an old custom long before Luther, were no doubt a continuation of the instruction given to catechumens before baptism in the first ages of the church. From the 13th century onward, we meet with conciliary enactments which prescribe the frequent exposition of Christian doctrine. Thus, at the synod held under the Archbishop Peckham of Canterbury in 1281, it was decreed that every parish priest should instruct his people in the vernacular four times a year on the Creed, the Commandments, the Sacraments, etc. In 1466, a synod of the province of York reiterated this law. The councils of Bizet in 1246, of Albi in 1254, and of Lavore in 1368 went still further and required that doctrinal sermons should be given in parish churches every Sunday. The last-named synod even published a catechism to be used as textbook for instructions by the clergy in the diocese of Languedoc and Gascony. The duty of giving similar instructions to the faithful were also found inculcated in the statutes of the councils of Grand in Hungary in 1114, of Niesen in Poland in 1248, and of Treves in Germany in 1227. In Germany, in the 15th and 16th centuries, priests were often urged to recite from the pulpit every Sunday the Our Father and the Creed, and sometimes also the Hail Mary and the Decalogue. They were further required diligently to instruct the people on these heads. In 1502, the Basel parish priest, Johann Sargent, published a work for the use of preachers in which these points are developed. It must also be borne in mind in this connection that the 13th century saw the rise of the great mendicant orders, which were expressly founded for the purpose of preaching. They very soon spread into every country of Europe, preaching in the churches, on the streets, in the lanes and byways, so that again it could be said, as in the days of the apostles, their voice was heard in all the earth. Catechisms in the Middle Ages. We see then that contrary to the charge often made against the Middle Ages, the work of teaching religion and of preaching was very far from being neglected in those centuries. But what about the further claim that the Catechism originated with Luther? That the little book of popular religious instruction, arranged in the form of question and answer, and comprising all the chief heads of Christian doctrine, was unknown before his shorter catechism of 1528. Again, a brief glance at the facts as they existed will give us a satisfying reply here. From the 9th century on, there have come down to us numerous works of popular instruction composed in Latin and in the newly formed European tongues. Such, for example, were the Disputatio Pyrrhinum per Interrogationis et Responsionis, 9th century, which explained the principal points of Christian doctrine. Nocter's Exposition in Old German of the Lord's Prayer and the Creed, 9th century. Ottfried's Catechism, also in Old German, treating the Lord's Prayer, the Creed, and the symbol of St. Athanasius, a catalogue of mortal sins, and the Gloria in Excelsis, 9th century. The Manual of Duda to his son, explaining Christian faith and morality, 9th century. The Explanation of the Our Father and the Creed by Bruno of Würzburg, 11th century. Beginning with the 12th and 13th centuries, catechisms and works of popular instruction were so numerous that we must here confine ourselves to mention of only some of the most important. Such were the Elucidarius of Honorius of Autun, 12th century, arranged in the form of questions and answers, and afterwards translated into many modern languages, the Baxhoniana, paraphrase of the Creed in Old German, 12th century, the Septenarium of Hugh of St. Victor in question and answer form, 12th century, Jocelyn of Sosuan Exposition of the Creed, 13th century, St. Thomas Aquinas Explanations of the Lord's Prayer, Hail Mary, the Creed, the Ten Commandments, and the Sacraments, 13th century, a treatise on Christian doctrine for the use of children, published in Italian, 13th century, the Catechism of Friar Lawrence, or Royal Catechism, embracing all the principal heads of Christian doctrine, written in the 13th century and translated into French in 1481. In the 14th century appeared Cardinal Thoresby's Lay Folks Catechism in Latin and English, and a catechism based on the septenarium which the Archbishop of Toledo addressed to his clergy. Among the many catechisms and works of popular instruction which appeared between 1400 and the date of Luther's birth in 1483, may be mentioned Gerson's ABC of Simple Folk, The Ordinary of Christians, The Art of Dying by Matthew of Krakow, The Treasure of Mankind, all in French, Montaigne's Treatise on How to Live and Die Well, written in Spanish, The Christian's Mirror of Brother Dietrich, The Guide of the Soul, The Consolation of the Soul, The Table of a Christian Life, each in German. Just before Luther's rebellion in 1517 appeared in German Lindau's Explanations of the Commandments. In Italy, Savonarola's Expositions of the Our Father, the Hail Mary, and the Decalogue. In France, the Art of Living Well and of Dying Well. In England, the Teaching of Wisdom, the Maniple of Pastors, the Art of Living Well and the mirror of a Christian. Two of the most widely known works for priests in the 30 years before Luther's day were the Fundamentum Aeterni Felicitatis and the Disciplis de Eruditione Christi Fidelium Compendiosus. Both books treat the four main points of Christian doctrine, namely the Creed, the Sacraments, the Commandments, and the Lord's Prayer. The former is written in question and answer form. The latter contains questions and objections. Before Luther's rebellion, we know that there was also a widespread custom of printing portions of the Catechism on separate tablets or sheets to be hung on the wall in order to facilitate the learning of religion. Until recently, it had been falsely supposed that Luther was the originator of this form of catechetical instruction. Numerous prayer books and manuals on confession, containing abundant matter regarding the sacraments and all points of doctrine, were another means of disseminating religious teaching before Luther's time. From the foregoing enumeration, which is only a part of what might be given, it ought to be quite plain that before the outbreak of Protestantism in the 16th century, instead of there being a dearth of popular religious manuals and literature, there was rather, as Zeschwitz says, an overabundance of material in the domain of catechetics. If to the brief survey so far given of ecclesiastical legislation, preaching, schools, and literary production during medieval times, we add but a casual consideration of the manifestations of faith which stamp these ages apart, we shall have a final and most convincing argument that popular religious instruction could by no means have been generally neglected in the centuries that preceded the rise of Protestantism. And this is all the more remarkable in view of the gigantic task that confronted the church with the downfall of the ancient civilization on the one hand, and of the more or less ceaseless troubles it had to encounter thereafter from the attacks of barbarous peoples and the hostility of civil rulers on the other hand. In spite of the unparalleled difficulties, far from those ages being times of religious ignorance and neglect, there never was a period in which the things of the mind and the soul were more highly prized and more zealously cultivated. Then it was that without the advantages of printing and of modern conveniences and means of transportation, the scriptures and writings of the fathers were preserved, transcribed, and disseminated in thousands of copies by the patient labor of the monks. Then were erected and established the many schools and colleges out of which grew the great universities and seats of learning of Europe. Then were planned and constructed those magnificent churches, chapels, and cathedrals, those masterpieces of religious art, which are at once a living testimony of the intelligent, ardent faith of the people and the marvel and admiration of all succeeding ages. Then were developed in the highest degree the arts of painting, sculpture, music, and poetry, for the purpose of being used both to revere the mysteries of faith and to teach their meaning to the people. Then it was that the church sent forth her apostles and the members of her newly founded mendicant orders to instruct the faithful and evangelize the pagans. Then it was that, having found the races of Europe savage and barbarous, she made them civilized, having found them pagan slaves of idol worship. She turned them to the service of the true God and of the crucified. Then it was that the nations were united in the one true faith of Christ, that religion was the dominant factor both in public and in private life, that faith yielded its highest fruits of piety and holiness in every rank of society, in king and subject, in scholar and peasant, in statesman and soldier, in cleric and layman. Then indeed, if we can judge by results, must the spirit of religion have been perceived and appreciated to a degree unequaled, since at that time appeared its fairest and most varied flowers, since faith was then so fruitful as to give its very name to those ages. If now, however, we pause to ask how it was possible, in view of the picture we've just drawn of the centuries immediately preceding the revolt of Luther, that whole nations should have given up the faith of their forefathers, and this in a comparatively short time, the answer is to be found not in one, but in a variety of causes. First, there had been the great schism of the West and a gradual relaxation of discipline, which had weakened authority and opened the way to many scandals and unpunished abuses in the ranks of the clergy. At the close of the Middle Ages and dawn of the New Era, the papacy had been too eager in the pursuit of humanistic aims, had cultivated too exclusively merely human ideals of art and learning, and at the same time had become entangled in secular business and politics, and was altogether too worldly. Moreover, in Germany at this time, the bishops were mostly younger sons of princely or noble houses who were quite unfitted for their spiritual work. And as for the lower clergy, secular and religious, while many were zealous to diffuse religious knowledge by catechetical teaching, sermons, instructive publications, and educational work in the elementary and middle schools, too many others were quite neglectful of these sacred duties. In truth, at the time of Luther's first appearance, in many parts of Germany there was no regular, systematic religious instruction of the young by the clergy or in the schools, but the children were left to pick up what they could in the home or from the public sermons. There were indeed regulations in force for the priests and the schools, but they were not acted upon. Another cause which greatly contributed to the defection was that in many places the leaders of the movement against the church were ecclesiastics who before had been acting as the people's guides and whose influence, consequently, could not easily be ignored. Thirdly, and especially, the rebellion was fomented and fostered by the civil rulers in Germany, Scandinavia, England, and elsewhere, who, taking advantage of the disorder, saw in the rebellion a coveted opportunity of gaining absolute control over the people and of confiscating the immense wealth of the church, and hence gave to the religious leaders a support without which the revolt everywhere would have failed utterly. Uniting to the above influences the popular unrest and love of novelty which characterized the 16th century, and the discontented and evil elements that are present at all times in every society, we can easily understand how the apostasy could be so far-reaching in spite of the general diffusion of religious knowledge and the devoted zeal of a great part of the clergy and of a mass of the people. Furthermore, there was the recent invention of printing, which enabled the heretics to circulate, broadcast their perverse teachings, thus confusing and deceiving the minds of the simple folk. Straightway, the reformers set about publishing catechisms of their own. About 40 different works of this kind were produced by disciples of Luther between 1522 and 1529, and in 1530 appeared Luther's own larger catechism called the Deutsche Catechismus. Besides these, numerous other catechisms were published by the different sects, such as that of Bucer in 1534, that of Berne in 1552, the catechism published by Calvin in 1536, that of the English Church contained in the Book of Common Prayer in 1549, and the Heidelberg Catechism of the Dutch Reformed Church in 1563, which spread into Switzerland, Austria, and Holland. One of the most pernicious features of the multitude of catechisms which the sectaries circulated far and wide was that their errors were so veiled under a semblance of piety that the unsuspecting faithful were deceived with incredible facility. Meanwhile, the defenders of the faith were far from being idle. Nothing was left undone to stem the tide of error that was sweeping over Christendom. In particular, The Sunday school and the Confraternity of Christian Doctrine were organized, and a great number of catechisms were at once published to counteract the baneful influences of those preceding from heresy. In Germany alone, we find 20 or more different writers of such manuals. One of the most famous of these, published at Vienna in 1555, was the Catechism of Peter Canisius, S.J., which was soon translated into a dozen different languages. Works of the same kind appeared in great numbers in Holland, France, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Mexico, and wherever the civil power was not completely under the control of the heretics. The Catechism of Trent. But good as were these individual and separate works, the Church at the Council of Trent, assembled December 13, 1545, seeing the need of a uniform and comprehensive manual which would supply parish priests with an official book of instruction for the faithful, ordered the preparation of the work which has ever since been variously known as the Catechism of the Council of Trent, the Catechism for Parish Priests, the Roman Catechism, or the Catechism of Pius V. It was some months, however, after the opening of the Council before mention was made of any kind of catechism. This was during the fourth session, on April 5th, 1546. 8 days later, the draft of a decree was read, proposing that there be published in Latin and in the vernacular a catechism to be compiled by capable persons for children and uninstructed adults who are in need of milk rather than solid food. The purpose of such a manual was to afford instruction for beginners in the primary duties of a Christian life, and to prepare them for further and higher religious education. The idea met with general approval, but as the council was occupied with matters more pressing, we hear nothing further about it until 16 years later, in 1562. According to some, the question of the catechism was brought up by St. Charles Borromeo during the 18th session, and a commission actually appointed on February 26, 1562. What is certain is that the papal legates, after a protracted discussion, had named a committee before the end of that year, for on January 3, 1563, they informed the procurators of Charles IX and of Ferdinand I of the existence of such a committee, and assured them that work on the catechism was already underway. The principal members of this committee, besides its president, Cardinal Sarapandi, were Leonardo Marini, Archbishop of Lanciano, Adigio Foscarari, Bishop of Modena, Muzio Collini, Bishop of Zara, and Francesco Ferrero. There were many other collaborators. Chief among them were Michael Medina, a Franciscan, and Christopher Sancto Tisocio, who assisted with the fourth and ninth articles of the Creed, respectively. Four French theologians, to whom were assigned the first four commandments, the Dominicans John de Laderno, Benedict Urba, Eliseus Capus, and the Franciscan Alphonsus Contreras, to whom were given respectively the fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth commandments. A theologian of Granada was entrusted with the last two commandments of the Decalogue. The following appear to have collaborated on the sacraments: three Flemish theologians on baptism, confirmation, and the Eucharist, Nicholas Ormanitis on the sacrament of penance, Peter Fernandez on matrimony, Cosmos Damiani, abbot of the Augustinian canons regular on orders, Arius Montanus on extreme unction. All those who had part in the work of the catechism were instructed to avoid in its composition the particular opinions of individuals and schools, and to express the doctrine of the universal church, keeping especially in mind the decrees of the Council of Trent. During the 24th session, the work on the catechism was brought to the attention of the council itself at a meeting on September 11, 1563. After various discussions, a new plan was adopted. Instead of a manual for children and uninstructed adults, it was decided to prepare a much more extensive and more thorough work to be used by parish priests in their instruction of the faithful. A final decree regarding such a catechism was passed in a general meeting of November 2nd of the same year, wherein it was enjoined on all bishops to see that the catechism should be faithfully translated into the vulgar tongue and expounded to the people by all parish priests. As the council was about to close, the catechism committee, as it appears, were ordered to submit to the assembled fathers the work they had so far accomplished. This was done at the general meetings between the 22nd and the 25th of November, and as the work was not finished, the Holy Father was requested to take charge of it and to see that the catechism was brought to completion and published. The manuscript was therefore carried to Rome, and the work was continued with little delay. Meanwhile, Cardinal Serapandi died, and St. Charles Borromeo was appointed to succeed him as president of the Catechism Committee. On December 21, 1564, Bishop Foscarari also died. To complete the work, the new president enlisted the services of several more theologians, such as Gabriel Paliotti and the Portuguese Statius. In order that the literary style of the catechism might be in keeping with the sublimity of its doctrine, St. Charles called to its service the greatest masters of the Latin tongue of that age. These were Paulus Mantuis, Giulio Poggiani, Cornelius Amalthius, Silvius Antoninius, and Pietro Galassini. When the work was finished, a first revision of the style was undertaken. The polishing of the first two parts was done by Cellini, who had already been engaged in the composition of the catechism. The third part was attended to by Galassini, and the fourth by Poggiani. This revision seems to have been completed by the end of the year 1564. Early in the following year, by order of St. Charles, who desired to secure absolute uniformity in the style, a second literary revision of the entire work was made by Poggiani. Meanwhile, Pius IV died and was succeeded on January 17, 1566, by Pius V. One of the first acts of the new pontiff was to appoint a number of expert theological revisers to examine every statement in the catechism from the viewpoint of doctrine. Chief among these revisers were Cardinal Serlet and the two Dominicans, Thomas Manrique and Eustachius Locatelli. By July of that year, the work of the catechism was finished, but it was not until the close of the year that it appeared under the title Catechismus ex decreto concili tridentini ad parocos pia the ponti max jussu editus. The text of the Tridentine Catechism. The first editions of the Catechism were printed without headings of any kind and with hardly any break in the text beyond an occasional paragraph. This arrangement, however, appeared unsatisfactory to Pius V, who therefore ordered that in subsequent editions the book should be divided into parts, chapters, and paragraphs. The questions that are found in most editions were originally drawn up by A. Lefebvre of Munich, and first appeared in the Antwerp edition of 1587. Hence it is clear that these question headings form no part of the original catechism. The same can be said of the Praxis Catechismi, an adoption of the text to the Sunday Gospels and Epistles, found at the end of the book in most editions, which we first meet with in the edition of Serafino Crucio in 1645. This idea, however, seems not to have originated with Crucio, who tells us that he got it from a French edition, published a few years before at Bordeaux. The original manuscript of the Catechism is not extant, but of the innumerable Latin editions that have appeared, the earliest are the Manutian, Rome, 1566, so called because it was printed by Paulus Manutius by command of Pope Pius V, that published by De Ferris in Venice, 1567, the Aquensian, Cologne, 1567, that brought out by Curver, Paris, 1568, a second Venetian edition in 1575, the Ingolstadt edition of 1577, and the Fabrician Antwerp, 1587. Among later Latin editions may be mentioned the following, issued at Rome, the edition of 1761, which contains the encyclical of Clement XIII on the excellence and the use of the Roman Catechism, the propaganda editions of 1858, 1871, and 1907. As was observed in the propaganda edition of 1858, the Manutian text was by far the best. Hence, the editors of that edition, desiring to produce a critical text, used the first Manutian as their basis, diligently comparing it with the best among the other Latin editions. Let us continue with the introduction to the Catechism of the Council of Trent on side B of this tape.